Thank you, everyone. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really glad to be here, and I want to thank Carl and the committee for inviting me up here. And Carl looked vaguely familiar to me. Seems like, I think I just settled with him down L.A. Wednesday night. I'm not sure. It's good to see a lot of people here that I know, and people from Southern California that I never, ever get to see. And it's nice to see Cliff and Tracy and several people here from Southern California that I never get to see. I used to drink a lot. You might suspect that. I walked into a bar when I was 18 years old. And in California, you're supposed to be 21. But I passed for 21. I ordered my drink, and the guy gave me the drink. And immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man. And a man can buy a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. And I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. I just felt comfortable there. I could sit at the bar, and as Nora May used to say, I could get better looking after each drink, look at myself in the mirror. And I just went back to that place every opportunity I had from then on. And sometimes you hear people talk in AA about when they came to AA, they just felt like they came home. It was just wonderful. Yeah. Not me, I'll tell you that. But I felt at home at that bar. And I went back every opportunity I had from then on. And I had done a little behind the gym drinking before that, but this is big time. And I could act grown up. And, I started smoking when I was 11 years old to try to look grown up. And now I was really grown up. I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls? We moved out to West Covina, a little town out of L.A., and bought a little crack house out there. Story's kind of like Karen and John's, my payments were $56 a month. That included interest and taxes, the whole shot. Nothing down, of course. I had trouble making those payments. Payments had come due on the first of the month, and I couldn't come up with the payment. Because I use my money to drink with. And I said, I'll double up next month. And next month would come along, and I'd have to come up with $112. My God, where am I going to come up with that kind of money? And so I'd stiff one of my other creditors, or three or four of them, and I'd make the payment somehow. And, we finally had to sell that place. And before they foreclosed out from under us, and we moved in with my father for free. I always thought, Hank, if anyone would have asked me, Hank, what is your problem? I would have said, money. Money's my problem. I just don't make enough. How do I ever get involved in that kind of work that I'm doing? I just don't pay enough. If she would only go to work and help out a little bit, But no, instead it turns out she was pregnant. And she had had a baby by a previous marriage, and now the second one's coming along, and hell, I didn't start saving for that baby until about a week before it was due. I couldn't come up with the money, so I went to the beneficial finance company. And I borrowed the money to pay the doctor bill and the hospital and medical expenses. And, when my son finally turned 25 years old and I finally got sober in AA, I finally got beneficial paid off. I don't know about you people, but I always had a crisis in my life. Every time I'd just about get them paid off, something would happen, and I'd have to consolidate again. I'd go up there and consolidate all my bills, and I'd something would happen, the part of that money on the way home, because when I got home, I never had enough to really pay off all the bills. So then I'd go to the Pacific Finance Company and borrow the rest. And sometimes I'd have a bank loan going, too. And at income tax time, that's pretty good. You have all this interest you're paying out. You can deduct, But I always used to wonder, what in the hell are you buying? What are you making all these payments on? You're not buying a thing. You're just making payments. I finally figured it out after I was sober a couple of years. What I did is I financed 30 years of drinking. Every time I took a drink, I paid an extra 10 or 15 cents interest to beneficial finance. And I don't have to do that anymore, thank God. But my drunkalogue is really a boring story. My God, you hear such exciting things sometimes from these podiums. They get up here and tell stories. I mean, They make some of these guys, they really know how to drink. Like they go into a bar and they punch everybody out in the bar, and the cops come and they punch the cops out too, and they get thrown in jail, and they walk over to the bunk they want, and they pull the guy out of the bunk and punch him out. You know, you know, that's drinking. That's exciting drinking. Another guy used to hear talking AA, used to hit telephone poles all the time, 100 yards off the highway. Another fellow was a jet pilot, and he went on a 3-week binge, and he woke up, came out of a blackout, going faster than the speed of sound at 30,000 feet. Now that is drinking. All I ever did is just sat around and drank. You know, I meant to do a lot of that stuff, I just never got around to it. You hear all this stuff, you know. I mean, a lot of people have dual problems in AA now. You know, they're alcoholics and drug addicts, and alcoholics and overeaters, and whatever. You know, I'm an alcoholic and a procrastinator. I always figure if a thing's worth doing, it's worth waiting until tomorrow to consider doing. And as a result, I used to just sit around and drink and watch the world go by, you know, and criticize people for participating in life. Now, I could do it a lot better if I really wanted to, you know. You can't blame a damn thing on me, I'll tell you that. I haven't done anything. I wound up in a little shack in Hermosa Beach, a half a block from the ocean. My wife had divorced me for the third time, and I figured, gee, this is going to be great. I'm half a block from the ocean. I'll be able to go down there along the shore every morning, and I'll run 5 miles, and then I'll take a dip in the ocean, and then I'll get ready for work, and I'll feel really good. You know, as far as I know, the water was down there. I just never really got around to checking it out in person. And this place I moved in was a garage, and they had made some living quarters, a little room, like a 12 by 15 room is what it was. And I bought a turntable and 10 speakers from a friend of mine. I had speakers in all four corners, behind the drapes, behind the couch, in the bathroom, in the kitchen. You name it, there was a speaker there. And a typical day for me was to wake up late to work. I'm already an hour late to work. My God, I'd throw my clothes on and get in that car and weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. And I left all these papers all over everywhere. And I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were just too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd be fired for holding them so long. If I didn't turn them in, I was going to be fired. I knew it was going to happen today, and I had that feeling of impending doom that they talk about around here in AA. I knew I'd get found out today. And I checked my desk out. Everything was the same as yesterday. Whew, saved again. I'd go get a cup of coffee and come back to my desk and shuffle papers and try to look interested and make excuses to my customers. They'd want to know where their stuff was, you know. You didn't get that in the mail? My God, you know. I don't know, the class of help we have to hire nowadays, they just don't understand what the word service means. I'll personally take care of that today myself. You can count on that. If you don't hear from me in the next few days, you know, call me again. Let's get this thing straightened out. And I'd say that a few times, and then I'd get tired of that, and then I'd start using the computer excuse. That's a good one. They're still using the computer excuse right to this day. You know, the computer's been down for the last 4 days. As soon as it gets working, I'll get a printout, and then I'll call you, and we'll get all this all straightened out. You know, hell, I'm one of the originators of the computer excuse. I used that excuse before we even had a computer, you know. At a respectable time, I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And they sold martinis over there. And I like martinis. They sold double martinis for $1 during the lunch hour. The regular ones were 75 cents. I figured, hell, you're going to have two anyhow. You might as well order the double one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money back. So I'd order the dollar martini. And I'd get to sipping on that. I'd kind of compare my drink to the guy sitting next to me at the bar, and he'd have a 75 center. And I'd say to myself, you know, I don't know who the hell they think they're kidding. This isn't really a double. If it was really a double, it'd be, you know, they'd be charging more money for it. It's just a little larger than the 75 center, so I better have another one. And then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one. Then I'd call the office, forgot to tell you, I'm going to a lot of calls, take messages, I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach and stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find, whatever was on sale that day, you know, whatever they were pushing that day in that dusty basket, you know, the cheapest stuff you could find. And I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'm kind of a neat drunk. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully so the creases fall properly, and put my shoes away and shirt and all that, and put my pajamas on. And I'd sit on the edge of that bed, and I'd untap this cheap vodka, and I'd take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows. And I'd say to myself, well, you've done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything, you know. Can't do it. And then I'd put one of these old 78 records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd start talking to myself. You can't do anything about your marriage, but at least you could get out of debt. Get a second job. Wait a minute, I'd say. You don't need to get a second job. You're in sales. If you're in sales, you can make any amount of money you want to, within reason, of course. My God, that's right, I'd say to myself. Starting tomorrow morning, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'll knock out paperwork for a couple of hours, and when that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, it's a whole new ball game. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to work, work, work. Sell, 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 Monday through Friday. Every waking hour, I'm going to make money. I can go in there on Saturday and clean up my paperwork. And hell, I got a key to the place. I'll go in on Sunday and I'll plan my work for the coming week. And if you're in sales, you know, if you plan your work and then work your plan, you can't miss. God, I felt so good about it. I thought I'd have another drink to celebrate. That's my solution to all my problems. My problems are really over. All I got to do is do it now, you know. But I've got the plan. And then I'd start worrying about the money I was going to make. I knew if I tripled my income, I'd be out of debt in no time. And what are you going to do with all the money then? And I had all sorts of plans for that money. I'd buy a white Lincoln Continental and drive up to that house where she still lives. And on the way up there, I'll stop at the Hallmark card shop and I'll buy the best card in the place, at least a dollar card, you know, no cheapie. And something with a lot of sentimental poetry on it, you know, sticky kind of poetry. And on the left-hand side, I'll write, "Thanks for all the good years, H." You know, not Henry, not Hank, just H. It's class. I don't know if you know class when you hear it, but that. And then I'll get a gold-plated key for the car. I'll put it in the envelope with the card, and I'll drive that Lincoln up, you know, like at midnight, and I'll hang a U-turn right there in the cul-de-sac, and I'll coast it right in front of the house at midnight, real quietly. And I'll tiptoe up on the steps, and I'll put that card with the key in it down the mail chute. Then I'll split. And the next morning, she'll get up and go through her routine. And come time to get her mail, she'll get her mail. She'll see that big envelope. Naturally, she'll open that one first. And the key will drop out. I wonder what that key is, she'll say to herself. And she'll read this poetry, sentimental kind. And tears will just roll down her cheeks. It'll just be excruciatingly painful for her to read that. And she'll look over on the left-hand side, and she'll see, "Thanks for all the good years, H." Then she'll get to looking at that gold-plated key, trying to figure out what that key's for. Somehow she'll look out in the front of the house and see that white Lincoln Continental out there, brand new, shiny, gorgeous, you know. And then she'll put it all together that that's her automobile. Then she won't think I'm so bad. Then she'll be sorry, by God. And I don't know about you people, but I just get a hell of a lift when I give those big gifts like that. Really feel great. So I have another drink. And play another record. Yeah. I look up at the clock and it'll be like 10:45. It can't be 10:45. I just sat down on the edge of this bed a few minutes ago. I called the operator and checked. Yep, 10:45. God, I can't believe it. And then I realized I was almost out of booze. So I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and I'd run 2 blocks to the liquor store. I had to get there before it closed. And that's when I first started jogging, about that time. I had to get there. And I'd get there just as the guy was closing up, bottle of Smirnoff's. And I always bought the better brands there in the neighborhood. I wouldn't want to think I was cheap right around where I lived. And I could stroll back to my shack with peace and comfort and contentment and security for the rest of the night. And I'd get home and have a few more drinks and play a few more of those old records. And, I went all over the world. I traveled all over the world sitting on the edge of my bed. And I bought boats and I bought Cadillacs and Mercedes Benz. That's what I did. I did a lot of things. And it was just real. It was real. All the rest of the stuff, the working and everything, was not really real. This was the real stuff. And so, that's how rehearsing the speech I was going to have to give at the banquet, because I knew I was going to be salesman of the year. And somewhere in there, I'd pass out. And I'd wake up the next morning, it'd be 10 o'clock, and I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, geez, I'd throw my clothes on real fast and shave and get in that car and weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. I left all these papers all over my desk, and some of those papers in my desk drawer were months old, and I knew if the boss were to find them, I'd be fired. This was it. This was the day I was going to get found out. I knew it, and I had that feeling. I just knew it. And I'd get there and check everything out, and everything's the same as yesterday. Whew, saved again. Go get a cup of coffee, go back to my desk and sit there and shuffle papers and try to look interested and make excuses to my customers. And at a respectable time, I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I was. I'd go over there and make my big decision of the day, whether to have the dollar one or the 75-center. Then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one. Then I'd call them and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going to a lot of calls, take messages, I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And head towards the beach and stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find and get home about 2 or 2:30 and hang up my clothes and put my pajamas on. Sit on the edge of the bed and untap this cheap vodka and take a big, big jolt out of it. I'd say to myself, this cannot continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. Then I'd put one of these old 78s on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" Then I'd have another one. Then I'd go into my fantasy and buy Lincoln Continentals and whatever. I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. And the only reason I still stayed with that company is because I always made my quota in sales, because they'd scare me. I was afraid I would be fired, so towards the end of the month, I'd just make a superhuman effort, and I'd work around the clock, and I always made my quota, and they always give me a plaque every year with my name on it for outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge and being the type of representative we want to represent this company and all that good stuff all over these plaques. For 8 drunken years in a row, I won a plaque every year. And then I got sober. And I didn't win a plaque for 8 years. I lost my motivation. You scare me enough, and man, I can really work. You put the pressure on me, and I can work. Take the pressure off, and I just kind of take it easy. Fear motivates me. In fact, after 2 years of sobriety, I walked in the office one day, and the boss told me I was fired. You gotta be kidding. Fire me with my outstanding sales record? I can't accept this. He says, "Well, you don't have an outstanding sales record anymore." So I went to see the regional manager of this company and pleaded my case. I used to say that I took my fourth step, my fifth step with him, but actually what I did is I sniveled and cried to him. You know what they want to do? They want to fire me down there at the office. Can you believe that? Me, with my outstanding sales record. And I said, you know, what they don't know is that about 2 years ago, I completely changed my life. I quit drinking. I'm trying to make it with my wife again, the kids. I'm trying to pay my bills on time and become a citizen in the community again and help poor unfortunates such as I recover from a seemingly hopeless disease. And now they want to fire me down there. Can you believe that? He says, Hank, I had no idea you had any problems with alcohol. Geez, I sure hope you and your wife make it. Everything works out for you. But I can't interfere with what goes on at the branch office. You know, if you claim to be a salesman, I'll put you on paid leave of absence for a very short period of time. He says, claim to be a salesman, go sell yourself to another branch office. And that's what I did. And I just completed 25 years with that company. It used to scare me every once in a while after that. Every once in a while, I'd win a plaque. Thought I was going to have a slip or something. But I finally finished and got through that. What happened to me is what happens to a lot of people in AA. Some of us, after we get sober, we think we should be rewarded just for being sober. And also, some of us just get so spiritual that we just sail off into the blue. And that's what kind of happened to me. I just was a cut above the average AA member. You know, you guys have to do your everyday mundane things, but, you know, I'm spiritual and I'm going with God, and I don't have to work near as hard as the rest of you guys. All I got to do is show up at work, and that was no problem after I got sober. You know, my sponsor finally got to me, and he told me, he says, you know, some of us, after we get sober, we just get so heavenly, we just become of no earthly good to anybody. And he pointed out that in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that it states in there that it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but we should keep our feet firmly planted on the ground, that's where our fellows are, and that's where the work is to be done. And that's what I've tried to do ever since. And before all that happened, my son had to come and live with me. You know, he didn't want to, but I got a call from my ex-wife and told me, come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are. And seems that he had gone to a party and he was in high school getting in a lot of nickel and dime trouble. Nothing big, just a lot of small stuff. But he had gone to a party and did a little drinking and came home and threw up on the carpet or whatever it was. It was the last straw, I know that. And she called and said, come and get your drunken son. And, you know, I should have said, I had no self-worth back in those days. You know, I should have said, now, wait a minute, you know. You can't handle him. You want him in the divorce action. You keep him, you know. You're having trouble? Well, that's your problem. Yeah. But no, I had no self-worth. She said to come and get him. I just went and got him, that's all. And he didn't want to come and live with me, and I didn't want him to come and live with me. But she said, so we had to do it, right? Well, she took lessons from Karen, I'm not sure. He used to come and visit me occasionally before that and spend the weekend with me. I never knew what do you say to a 16-year-old kid? I could never think of of anything to say. I figured, well, you know, what would a real father say if you... if I wasn't drinking, I started criticizing him about his grades. And how come you're not playing football? And it just amazes me that you're not at least class president anyway. All the things that I kind of wish I would have been when I was in school. But if I was drinking, which was most of the time, I just tended to slobber all over him and tell him how much I loved him. All the trouble your mother and I have had through the years has nothing to do with you. We love you. And I used to corner him. He couldn't escape from me. You know how that is when you start talking like that, you can't quit, or I can't anyhow. And I just would pour it on, tell him just what a wonderful kid he was and how much I loved him and all these, and over and over. And just he'd look at me with that look in his eyes, and I never will forget it. And he'd just squirming, you know. And finally he'd escape somehow. And I'd wake up the next morning and I'd just be ashamed of myself. Not that I had been drunk the night before, but that I had let my guard down and told my son I loved him. I'm from the old school where you don't show any emotion to anybody at any time. I practiced that all my life. They call it looking cool. That's what I practiced, being cool all my life. I used to go to these jazz joints and real famous musicians blowing trumpets and saxophones, you know, and all the squares were snapping their fingers and stamping their toes. I could just sit there in the midst of all that with a cigarette in one hand, a drink in another, and never move a muscle. Just sit there and listen to all this, you know. Now that's cool. And I practice that in every area of my life. We just don't show any emotion to anybody. So I was ashamed of myself. I couldn't look at my son in the eye. I'd get him in the car and drive him home and dump him off. God, never do that again. And it wasn't very much longer after that that she moved in with us, too. She came down and checked him out one time. And so we had a talk. And I don't know if you've ever had any of those kind of talks, but it was a Sunday afternoon, and we got to talking, and we started kind of promising things to each other. She'd promise me one thing, and then I'd promise her another, and then she'd promise me. And we promised all this real good stuff to each other all afternoon. It was just a wonderful afternoon. And I think we knew we couldn't fulfill any of those promises, but it was fun. You know? In fact, one of the things she said is that I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you. And I should have been suspicious right then and there. Because you see, she never drank. She never drank when I was married to her. And she was afraid to. She always knew she was an alcoholic. When she talked in Alcoholics Anonymous, she always used to say she was born an alcoholic, and she knew it. She was afraid to drink because she had a father that was quite a bit like her, had a good personality, and everybody liked him. But God, he'd take one drink, and he was off to the races, you know. He'd disappear for days, and they'd find him at hospitals and stuff like that. And she was afraid that she would be like that. And she had a good reason to believe that, because that's exactly what happened. And I'm not here to take her inventory or anything like that, but I'm going to just tell you a few of the things that she did while she was. It'll help you understand my case a little better. She did stuff like throw the Christmas tree lights and all out the back door, you know. Just because I'd play a record more than once, for some reason that used to irritate her. Most alcoholics like to hear music, and I'm no exception. I'd put one of these old 78 records on the turntable and play it, and I hadn't heard it for a week or two. I've been listening to it for the last 25 years, and it was just like a new song. And I'd play it. My God, that's a good song. I'd play it one more time. Jesus, that's good. Play it again. Sometimes I'd get hung up on a trumpet toot. I'd lay that needle in there. Toot. Oh, man. It's really, you know, do that one more time. That used to drive her crazy. She'd go over the phonograph and take the 78 off the turntable and whang. My God, don't break those. Those are collector's items. You can't replace those. Good. I'll never have to hear that again. One time she walked over the phonograph and just took the arm and bent it up. I couldn't play any more records that night, I'll tell you. Next morning I got up and got a pair of pliers and a hammer and screwdriver and started trying to straighten that arm out. I couldn't get it straightened out. I don't know how she got it. That strength that she could do that. She'd never remember the thing. Next morning, she would never remember anything that she had done. You don't remember what you called me last night? Oh, what? Don't give me that. And she claimed that she never could remember any of that stuff. Now, I don't know. I didn't know about blackouts until I came to AA. I just never did black out. Some of us remember and some of us don't. I just one of us that remember. I don't know which is worse, but I kind of like the idea, you know. At least I know what I did. And I'm ashamed. But she claimed that she was born an alcoholic. I think in my case, I drank myself into alcoholism. I had a lot of fun with booze for a long time. It did the job it was supposed to do for me. It enabled me to function socially. You know, I could work okay without booze. But anything social, I had to have something to drink. Either before, during, or after, and generally all three. And romancing, any of that kind of stuff, I had to have booze. And it did the job well for a lot of years, and then I became allergic to it. You know, I didn't know it, but I did. And the same thing happened to me with penicillin. You know, I took penicillin several times. The last time I took penicillin, I wound up in the hospital for 8 days. I almost died. The doctor came to me and he says, you know, you shouldn't have taken penicillin, you know, Nick. You're allergic to that stuff. I said, no kidding, jeez. And I said, how come? I've taken it before and it's always worked before. He said, well, don't ever take it again. You might die the next time. Really? Okay, I promise. I'll never take it again. And I haven't. I've got about 35 years without a shot of penicillin. I haven't had to go to a meeting or anything. I haven't had to join any kind of an organization. I haven't had to get a sponsor about it or a thing. It hadn't been necessary for me to call somebody up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, I've got this uncontrollable desire to take a shot of penicillin. I just quit cold turkey. It's been over 35 years now. And the same thing happened to me with booze, yeah. Penicillin did its job for a long time, and then it stopped. And I didn't realize it, but that's what booze had done, too. It stopped working. And we could never drink together. We always had a rough time drinking together. So finally, I told her one night, I says, you know, I've had it. I says, yeah, I allowed you to kick me out of all those other houses, but, you know, I moved here first. Therefore, you go this time. And I said, I'm going to stay at my brother's house tonight. When I come back tomorrow morning, I expect you gone. This isn't working out any better than it used to. And so I went to my good brother's house that night. You know, the one that you can knock on his door at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and if you got something in a brown paper bag, he'll just pull you right in. And we sat up and philosophized all night. And it seemed like his wife didn't understand him either. We picked a couple of losers, and we had that in common. So while I was gone, she decided to commit suicide again in a blackout. That was one of her character defects. She was always committing suicide. Now, when anything happened, why, you don't work through it, you just knock yourself off, that's all. And so this night, she was going to do it again. And in a blackout. But before she did, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and just took a knife and just slashed every bit of clothes, just ripped everything to pieces and cut my ties in half and my shirts and even stabbed my damn shoes and made a complete shambles out of everything. Then she took the rags that she had made and put them around the doors and the windows of this place and tried to make the place airtight. And then she turned the gas on in the kitchen oven and went to bed in that little place. And she woke up the next morning, nothing happened. Hell, that old place was so old, the wind used to whistle through those boards, and you could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smelled it. So she survived again. And, you know, she was suicidal right into AA. She had about 8 months of sobriety, and something bad happened. I don't know what it was. And must have been serious because she was going to do it again. And then she realized she couldn't commit suicide that day because she was the cookie lady at the meeting that night. I guess some of you wonder why they give some of us flaky people some of these jobs they give us. Well, hell, they're life-saving jobs. Her sponsor finally got to her and said, you better knock that crap off. You know, one of these days you're going to hurt yourself real bad. And anyhow, We had started back to group therapy. We went to group therapy in private sessions off and on for 15, 20 years. I don't know, a long time. And we were back to group couples workshop, they called it. That's where married couples go and cop out on one another. This therapist asked me, "Do you really drink as much as she says?" And I said, "Hell yes, I do. Who wouldn't marry to a woman like that? I got two of the worst children you could possibly imagine, and I got this pressured job. My God, the job alone would make a person drink. You know, but what in the hell is the big deal? So I drink. So what? They've never missed a meal. They've always had a place to live. They've always had their bicycles and layer-on cars and everything else, you know. And they haven't missed a thing just because I take a few drinks once in a while. And I just don't understand what the big deal is." So he said, "Have you ever thought of quitting?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I have, and I did. I thought about it every night. Starting tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, I'm going to quit." And he said, "Have you ever thought of going to AA?" And I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA." And I had gone to a meeting one time, and it was one of these meetings where they give chips. I don't know if they do that up here or not. But the leader said, "Has anyone just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip." And it's a poker chip, and it says "Easy Does It" on one side and 30 days on the other. And here comes this guy up, get his chip. "My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings, and I just love every single person here." "Just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. Wonderful, glorious way of life that we have here in AA. All you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you." And I went, "Oh, jeez." "Anyone else?" Here comes this lady. "My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and it's lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on, keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love every single person here. You know, hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. I love everybody, not just the people in AA, but everybody in the whole world. What a wonderful, glorious life that's here in AA. And just a short time ago, my children were failing in school, and now we're getting letters from all the major universities offering free scholarships, and just a wonderful, glorious way of life we have here. And wake up in the morning, and I reach over, and I grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand together. Just marvelous. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you." And I thought, oh, God. Hey, I never went back, I'll tell you that. And so this therapist said, "Have you ever thought of joining AA?" I, "Thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA. Some kind of a spiritual thing. I don't know, a religious cult of some kind. And it's okay for them, but it's just not for me." I said, "But you know, I am going to quit drinking. I'm just tired of listening to it, and I'm going to quit." And I said, "I read an article about some stuff called anabuse. I think I'll get some of that. But I'm going to quit once and for all." And so he put me in touch with this doctor, and I made an appointment with a doctor. And the doctor's receptionist said, "Well, if you want anabuse, don't drink for at least 48 hours prior to the appointment, and your appointment's a week from next Tuesday," or whatever it was. I didn't drink during that 48 hours prior to that appointment. And I walked in there for my anabuse, and the doctor checked my blood pressure, and my heart and everything, and called me into his office, and he started talking to me about the disease of alcoholism. You know. And he said, "You know, if you haven't drank for 48 hours prior to coming here to this appointment, I want to tell you something. You need never take another drink as long as you live. You're over the hump," he said. "You know, if you can stay sober for 2 days, you can stay sober forever." Gee, I'm kind of scared, little Henry, I'll tell you that. I wasn't quite prepared to quit that long right at that time. I just wanted to prove something. And he just went on and on and on about the disease of alcoholism, and how people that have the disease of alcoholism have character defects. and they refuse to cope with their problems. Instead of coping, they'll get drunk tonight instead. And they wake up the next morning, and they still got all their problems, only now they got a hangover on top of it. And they can, and then they keep repeating this over and over and over again. And he was telling me my story. I just didn't recognize it. And he says, so you don't really need antabuse. What I recommend to you... Yeah. And I says, well, Doc, if you're not going to give me any antabuse, then I guess I better go. How much do I owe you? And he says, I can see, he says, that I'm not making any impression on you. So I'm going to tell you something I wouldn't normally tell a patient, but due to the nature of your appointment here, I'm going to tell you something. He says, my wife's an alcoholic. And we've tried everything known to medical science for her. And we've tried rest homes and sanitariums and abuse and all the things, psychiatry, all the things. We've tried it all. And she's never able to quit drinking, but she's sober now. She goes to AA, and that's what I recommend that you do. And promise me that when you leave here, that you'll go to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and there'll be no charge for this call. And that was the only thing that guy said that day. It didn't impress me at all. And I went and I bought the book and threw it on my dresser and had another drink. Crazy damn doctor. Gee, he just didn't understand my case at all. Yeah. And then this fiasco happened. She had been with me and heard all that stuff that the doctor had said. So she went back and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know, but why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? And so she came home that night, and she said, I'm going to go to AA with the doctor's wife. And I said, oh, my God, be careful. Just remember what I told you about it. You know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. That means no names. Don't give them my name, whatever you do. I don't want anybody knocking on my door trying to convert me, I'll tell you that. And she went to a meeting, and they told her, the first thing they told her in AA, the very first thing they told her is what Karen mentioned today, you know, that it wasn't her fault that I drank. Hell, I had her convinced that it was her fault that I drank. But they said, no, if you're carrying that kind of guilt around with you, you're only kidding yourself. You can't make anybody drink. If you would have never met that guy, he would have drank anyhow. You can't make anybody drink. If you're carrying that kind of guilt around with you, you're only kidding yourself. And you can't make him quit either. We don't have that kind of power either, that we can make anybody quit drinking. So don't pour his booze down in the sink. He'll just go out and get another bottle. And, you know, if he wants, you know, if you think you've got a problem with booze, you think you've got a problem that you're an alcoholic, maybe you better come back to these meetings and work on your problem and just let that SOB drink himself to death. If that's what he wants to do, it's his life. And she kind of liked the ring of that. So she went to meetings, and every once in a while, to be a good guy, I'd go to a meeting with her. I hated the meetings, but I went, and I heard some good speakers. I heard Clancy, and I heard John A., and heard people and their laughter and everything. And I wondered, you know, God, you know, those guys are really interesting guys. I'd like to meet one of them. You know, maybe I could call John. And it really went over my head. I didn't realize that you weren't supposed to drink in between meetings, you know, because I used to have a few drinks just to get to the meeting. But somewhere along the line, I just didn't hear the message, you know. So I'm going to give it to you right now, you know. If you go to AA and you don't drink in between meetings, and then sobriety starts. But I didn't hear that. And I went to a lot of meetings. In fact, I couldn't wait to get out of there. I hated the damn meetings. It just seemed like those same two people were at every meeting I went to, and how wonderful their life had become. And I wanted to go home. And the meeting would end, and we'd all stand up and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. How hokey can you get? And you think you can go home then? Hell no. There's another meeting that starts immediately after the meeting. And that's where I could see these ladies start coming towards me. It just seemed like the closer they got, the longer hear their fingernails speaking. Their little fangs just growing. Like little miniature vampires coming towards me. And they were all looking for new blood. And they'd say, "Are you Lou's husband?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm Lou's husband." "Well, are you an alcoholic too?" And I'd say, "No, I'm not an alcoholic too. She's one. Work on her, but I'm not one." And I finally said, "This is it. I've gone to my last meeting. I can't stand it." And I said, "But you know, as much..." And I didn't pay any attention to anything that was said at those meetings. And I walked in and I just clicked off. And I absolutely did not listen to anything that had been said. But somehow or another, I still got the message. And I realized that I was an alcoholic. And so I said, "I'm not going to go to any more meetings, but I'm going to quit drinking." And I did. I quit drinking. No problem. A little bit before Thanksgiving. And I didn't drink through the drinking as part of the year, through the Christmas holidays. I bought Christmas presents that year and everything. And they didn't seem like they appreciated my sobriety all that much around the house, but by God, I was sober. And the Saturday night after Christmas, she went off to a meeting and I stayed home. I kind of took a little mini inventory of the situation. And I said to myself, "You know, if you haven't had a drink since before Thanksgiving, and you didn't drink through the drinking as part of the year, that proves something. Proves you were wrong. You're not really an alcoholic after all." So I went to the liquor store and I bought a half a pint of vodka. And I no sooner got it back to the house and I drank the half pint. What the hell did I buy a half pint for? I went and got a fifth. I went and bought another fifth. And I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday. I closed the bar up somewhere at 2 a.m. and I woke up the next morning. It was 10 o'clock and I'm already an hour late to work. You know, but you got to get in there, especially on Mondays. If you don't show up on Mondays, you're an alcoholic. And especially the Monday after a holiday, you've got to show up. And I did. You know, but I was hung over. I hadn't drank for a little over a month, and I poured all this alcohol into my system all at once, and God, I was sick. So I went over to the bar a little earlier that day, and I ordered a Bloody Mary, because that's what you order when you're sick, and it's not a social drink of any kind. It's just a glass of medicine, you know. And I drank this glass of medicine straight down. God, it hit bottom, and it put the fire out. Oh man, make me another one. I'd spilled half of it all over my tie, and I went to the restroom to clean the tomato juice off my tie. And when I got back, he said, "Did you want a Bloody Mary or did you want a martini?" And I said, "Oh, just skip it." And I went over to the coffee shop section of this bar. I had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. And that's been 17 and a half years ago. My pleasure. And I had no idea that was my last drink. I've often thought, had I known that was going to be my last drink, I sure as hell wouldn't have had a Bloody Mary. I could have had something in a fancy glass, and I could have drank it straight down, and then I threw that glass on the floor. Stomped out of the bar, triumphant over alcohol. But I didn't know it was my last drink. 2 or 3 weeks went by, and I kind of came out of my fog. And I found myself in AA meetings, of all places. And then anger set in. I had just completed 30 years of drinking. And I got this rotten wife and two of the worst children you could possibly imagine. And it's pressure job. I owe money to everybody, and it's all past due. And now I can't even drink. Now they've taken that away from me, too. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Nothing. There's nothing to do if you don't drink. I don't care what they say in AA, how wonderful. I've been sober 30 days. I know how good you feel after 30 days. Who in the hell are they kidding, anyhow? And my life is over. They might as well dig a hole. I'll jump in it and they can cover me up. I'll make it on time to work. I'll get there on time. I'll get home on time. I'll have dinner on time. I'll go to an AA meeting on time. And I'll get home and go to bed on time and get up in the morning on time. And it's a never-ending long gray tunnel and I'm, and my life is over. You can never go to a decent restaurant ever again. I'm stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. What happens when you go to a nice restaurant? First thing they want to know, would you like a cocktail before dinner? You can't say to them, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. It's of a twofold nature. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. If I even take one drink, I can't predict my behavior. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. I used to spend, you know, the biggest portion of my day explaining things to people that didn't want to hear the explanation. One of the things I'm trying to quit is explaining to people. Every once in a while I find myself in some long, involved explanation to somebody. And I realize what I'm doing. So I'll stop. Right in mid-explanation. They never notice the difference. It turns out no one's listening to that stuff. You know, no one wants to hear your explanations. No one's interested in your excuses why you haven't done something you were supposed to do in the first place. So I'm trying to quit all that. And I'm not. Sometimes I go for half a day. everything I knew for sure was all wrong. Everything I knew. Because, you know, I went to a nice restaurant. In fact, last night we were at a nice restaurant here, and I was observing the table next to us, and they were serving martinis over there. But, you know, sometimes I go into a nice restaurant, and the waitress will come up, or a waiter, and would you like a cocktail before dinner? I just, no thanks. Never even phases them. That's one of the cruelest things that I've experienced in AA. It's their indifference out there. If they cared one way or the other, it'd be okay. But they don't really care whether you drink or not out there. And that was one of the drawbacks I had about joining AA. What are they going to say when they find out I quit drinking? You know? Well, they don't give a damn. And that's pretty hard to take, I'll tell you that. But, you know, the sick part of this whole story is that sometimes I look over at that next table. And, they're, you know, when you say no thanks, well, then they just go to the next table and ask them. And I always check, and they're always thinking over there at the next table. And sometimes it'll be like a well-dressed couple, maybe celebrating an anniversary or something. And they'll have martinis. And, you know, and they'll be clicking their glass. Looks kind of nice. After 17 and a half years of sobriety, sometimes that looks good to me. You know, you can see a little droplet melting down the side of the glass. If you look close, you can see the olive in the glass. And if you look real close, you can see the pimento in the olive in the glass. And sometimes that looks good to me. You know, so I've decided when I die, I'm going to donate my brain to science. And when I die, they'll get my brain, they'll study it and see what a real alcoholic brain looks like, you know. And then when they get through studying it, and they'll put it in that solution, you know, in that alcoholic solution that they think. And when that brain hits that alcoholic solution, it's just gonna go through that. And then it'll finally calm down, you know. If you listen real close, I'm sure you'll hear it say, ah. Until then, I'll tell you, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to stay away from that first drink. I'm going to maintain my sobriety. I'm going to call my sponsor all the time. I'm going to read the big book. I'm going to go to a lot of meetings. I'm going to come to Portland. This is a pleasure to come here. I've gone to a lot of places that I didn't particularly want to go to. And that's okay, because I want to maintain my sobriety. And I hope I never have to drink again as long as I live. You know, I hope so. And it's not all fun and games. Sometimes it sounds like it's all fun and games here, but it really isn't. I'm very glad that when I was sober about 3 or 4 months, I got a sponsor. It's very important for guys like me to have sponsors, because I need someone to insist. You get a good sponsor, he'll insist that you work the 12 steps. You know, and it'll help you maintain your sobriety while you're working them. And he'll answer all those stupid questions that you've got to ask. You know, questions that you should have knew the answer to when you were in seventh grade or something. You went to the bathroom when they were passing out that information. You know? And that's the stuff you can call and ask your sponsor about. And they don't laugh at you too hard. You know? And I need that. I'm very grateful that I was able to work the steps because, you see, I'm not a very sincere person. You might have guessed that already. But I worked the steps. I joined this large group in Los Angeles and with a lot of people that were sober approximately at the same time as me, peers of mine. And we'd meet and we'd say, "What step are you on?" And they'd want to know what step I was on. I'd say, "What step are you on?" And they'd say, "I'm on step two." "Well, then I'm on step three." I always try to keep one step ahead of them. And somehow I worked all those steps. And I'll be damned if I haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps, just as if I'd have been sincere. And it seems it really doesn't matter as long as you work the steps. That's the important thing, it seems. And so I'm here tonight, and I'm really very grateful that I've worked them, and I've worked them more than once. And I try to work them on a continuous basis because, you see, you never know when the chips are going to come down, and you need those steps, or I need those steps as a platform for living, because I need something to. A lot of things happen to us after we get sober, drunk and sober, but I always kind of ignored them when I was drinking, and. But, you know, they expect you to handle all these things that are going to happen to you without drinking, without any booze, without any funny cigarettes, without any pills. You know, just cold turkey, handle all this stuff, you know. And every once in a while, I hear somebody stand up here and say, you know, "My best day..." No, that's not it. I always get this wrong because it sticks in my craw. "My worst day in sobriety is better than the best day I ever had while drinking." Not me. I had some great days drinking, some wonderful days drinking. You know, I had some bad ones too, but I had some wonderful days drinking. And I've had the worst days. I've had some of the worst days of my entire life sober in AA. You know, when you don't have any buffer, you know, you got to hit, this stuff hits you with the full force. And, you know, it can be hard to handle, and I've been able to cope with that without drinking. I didn't cope well all the time, but I've coped, and I haven't had to drink 17 and a half years, you know. But you never know when the chips are coming down. My wife, who finally got on, you know, was on the program, and we really had a stormy marriage for a lot of years, and we had some good years in AA together, but she got sick. And turned out she had cancer, and with 5 years in with cancer. And the last year, she didn't even know I was, didn't even know me. And, but you know, it was okay because, you see, by then I was dependable. By then I had worked the steps. By then I was able, being employed, I was able to provide good group insurance. And if I'd had $5 million, she couldn't have had any better care. And I hung in there with her, and it was okay. And she finally passed away, and it was a blessing that she did, because she had just, you know, it went up into her brain and all that stuff. And so when she left this way, it was okay. And that I don't have to sit around and mourn, because, you see, I had mourned enough while she was sick, and I had a choice to make when she died, you know. I can either play the role and be a mope and walk around and pretend, you know, this mourning bit. I'm not putting it down for people that are, but I'm through. I was through grieving. It was a relief that she went. If that sounds kind of hard, that's the way it is. Because, you see, the good thing about this is that I don't have any guilty feelings. You see, because our house was in order. Every once in a while you hear it read at meetings, a vision for you. They talk about having your house in order. And obviously you cannot help someone if your own house is not in order. Well, our house was in order. And everything that needed to be said had been said a long time before that. And we had some good years in AA. And she was a very active AA member and sponsored a lot of women in AA. And we had some good years. And so when she went, it was a shame, but I don't carry any guilt. Because, you see, it was all said and it was all done. And I don't have to say to myself, geez, if only I would have done this, if only I would have done that. I don't have those feelings. And I was able to make the choice whether I want to walk around with a long face and act sad or choose to live. And I've chosen to live. And I've recently retired from that job that I really haven't liked for the last several years. And I could hardly wait to get out of there, and I was able to retire. And it's like starting all over again. When you get sober, you know, you really are born again. Or at least that's the way I feel about myself. And now that I'm single, and now that I'm retired, it's a whole new life again. You know, I'm starting a new life. And I sold my house up on the desert where we lived. And I've always fantasized about buying a boat and sailing around the world. I sailed around the world several times from my bed. So I bought myself a boat and I got it parked in Marina Del Rey. And if someone would just help me start that damn thing. One of these days I'm going to be a sea captain. And to bring you people up to date, you know, my son that used to look at me so funny back in those days, part of the reason he was looking at me so funny was that he was stoned out of his gourd. It seems that he had a problem with booze, too, and pills, and LSD, and marijuana, the whole schmear. He went the whole route. And I'll be damned if he didn't turn himself into AA when he was 21 years old. And on May the 27th, he took a 14-year gig. And my daughter's son, he's 20, almost 21 now. He's got 2.5 years of sobriety. And every Wednesday, we go to the Pacific Group in Los Angeles, the largest meeting in the world. And that meets on a continuous basis every Wednesday. There's 500 to 700 people there every Wednesday night. And the three of us sit there and celebrate our sobriety together. And that isn't all that bad. And my daughter-in-law and my daughter both send you greetings from Al-Anon. And we're an AA family. And we weren't any kind of a family 17 and a half years ago. And we're still not the best family on the block. I wouldn't try to smell anybody around AA. But we've all got programs to work if we choose to work. I've met a lot of wonderful people in AA. God, I've met just marvelous people in AA. All the people that I was looking for out there in those bars, it turns out that they're sober here in AA. And I've just had the opportunity to meet some great people. But you know, I wouldn't trade places with anybody tonight. 17 and a half years ago, I'd have traded with anybody. But I'm satisfied with who I am tonight. And so it's a pretty good life after all. And it's an exciting life. And I'm having a great time. And I'm even going to start back to school in September, believe it or not. And it just, you know, every day is exciting. I'm having trouble coping with my new life. I'm just not used to this freedom. I'm used to being hemmed in and with the pressure on. And I can't, and I'm wasting a lot of days sometimes, I feel, but it's okay. So tonight, about the only message that I've got here to deliver you to you tonight is that what I heard in that first meeting that I ever went to. And it turns out that this really is a spiritual program. And I know that I found God when I walked through the door. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turned me on to come back. Thank you very much.